Jennifer, can I just actually make a very quick, I'll call it correction of what I said previously about this one enforcement case I was referring to? The company I was thinking about was Boston Scientific, and unfortunately, I probably thought there was a case against the people with the confirmations because perhaps I thought there should have been at the time, but it involved a Japanese subsidiary. There was 40 employees at the company that were involved. But what was surprising was that there was 143 independent distributors that participated in the fraud in terms of sending in false confirmations. Anyway, that was a commission enforcement case several years back involving Boston Scientific. But to the best of my knowledge, there was no action taken against the people that submitted the false confirmations.
Okay, thanks, Wayne. All right, so moving into emerging issues discussion, as I indicated this morning, we've moved this discussion till now after lunch. Really, the primary reason was we've been hearing a lot about fair value, although that's the FASB's been deliberating, and that we've been hearing whether or not the PCAOB should issue any type of guidance that would be helpful to auditors in connection with auditing under these new accounting standards or guidance issued by the FASB. We are interested in that issue, and so we'll start off with that. I've asked Peter from the FASB to give an overview of what the FASB board decided this morning and what we can expect to see. And then we can have a discussion. So, Peter, if you're ready.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks.
I did place a call, but since I was paying for the call myself, I kept it short. So I'll do the best I can. Let me start with there were really three actions related to fair value. So I'll just take them one at a time. In terms of this, what we refer to as the Statement 157 project or the FSP 157E, let me preface it by saying the objective was to provide application guidance on what you do when the market for an asset decreases significantly, and to provide additional information about identifying orderly and non-orderly transactions. The scope of that initiative is fair value measurements governed by Statement 157. One of the things, and maybe what I should say is, for the large part, the decisions made this morning are in line with the proposals that were published 2 or 3 weeks ago. There were a couple of variations. But what the board did say is that they need to make a much clearer statement that the measurement objective is the same as it was. It's the price for an orderly transaction at the measurement date. And what that means is reflecting the market that exists, not some other hypothetical market. And so the issue is, how do you evaluate actual transaction prices, those market trades that are available? And so the board is providing a list of factors. I think we had 7 of them in the ED. There were some additional factors that were suggested in the comment letters, which the board has reviewed and agreed to add some of those. They were not discussed in detail, or they were not specifically identified at the board meeting this morning. We've eliminated the two-step process for those who are familiar with the proposals. We had a two-step process where first you would identify whether the market was active or inactive, and if inactive, then you had some, there was a presumption that any transactions that were observable, there'd be the presumption that they were not orderly. That presumption has been removed. And so it's more of the concept is you should look at all data points and that it's appropriate to use alternative valuation techniques, a model, so to speak. I won't list the factors that were included. The circumstances for, so if there's observable trades, you may not have any information to be able to assess whether it was orderly or not. If you're not involved in the transaction, it might be hard to tell. If you can determine that it is orderly, then you probably want to go ahead and use it. If you can determine that it's not, you would wait that or not use it. The factors that you would consider are whether the transaction was because of a bankruptcy or someone heading towards bankruptcy, There were a couple of others. If the transaction was marketed to a single participant, or if you're able to determine that the price was really an outlier. I think the big change was the removal of the presumption that all distressed all transactions in an inactive market are distressed. The board wants to make clear that broker quotes or pricing services would be relevant if the methodology used to develop them is compliant with Statement 157. We're going to try to provide clearer examples. We had examples in the proposals. We're trying to clear those up to provide a little bit more of application guidance. And there was an added disclosure from the ED, really just to talk about the valuation techniques used and the inputs at a fairly granular level by asset class. We're referencing asset classes that are in 115 or 133 or whatever it is the guidances that you're using that tells you to measure at fair value. I'm going to come back to effective date afterwards because they're all linked together. On the issue we called other than temporary impairment, OTTI, the scope is debt securities. And again, for the large part, the decisions were in line with the proposals. The idea is that you would separate the credit from the non-credit impairment. The recognition trigger is based on intent to sell, or it's more likely than not that you will have to sell. If you cannot sustain that you're not going to be compelled, if you can't sustain that you are not going to be able to have to sell, then all the losses would go through earnings. But if you don't have an intent to sell, then the credit piece would go through earnings and the non-credit portion would go outside of earnings to OCI. The credit portion, in the way we're characterizing it, is based on the expected cash flows. We reference a FAS 114 type of an approach. There was some suggestions from some of the comment letters that the only loss that should be recognized in earnings, should be recognized at all, was the credit losses. And to do otherwise is inconsistent with the notion of hold to maturity. The board rejected that idea. In the income statement, both pieces would be shown. So it's a gross basis, so to speak. You have the total impairment minus the non-credit that's going to go to OCI. In terms of subsequent accounting, there would be a natural accretion the impairments that were recognized outside of earnings that will get you back ultimately to par. And when this is adopted, in the period that it's adopted, at the beginning of that period, beginning of that quarter, there would be a reclass between retained earnings and AOCI for the non-credit losses previously taken. And again, we added some disclosures, more information about inputs. The disclosures are required for interim and annual periods. Again, disaggregation by type of asset. We've identified the types of assets that we thought were good examples. And a description of methodologies used, and also a roll forward that would roll forward the amounts of the impairments from period to period. The other thing, and it might have been a little bit of a sleeper, but what the board also did was they required the disclosures that are a part of Statement 107 annually. They required on a quarterly basis. So that was a pretty minor change. In terms of effective dates, the board was trying to sync all of these up together. So where they landed, it's a little bit cumbersome. Basically, we're marrying up the FAS 157 and the other than temporary impairments together. So if you adopt one, you have to adopt the other, and vice versa. But you don't have to adopt 107 at the same time. However, if you adopt the 107, then you have to do the fair value and the OTTI. Okay, so when is it effective? It's going to be required for periods ended after June 15th, 09, with earlier adoption permitted for periods ending after March 15th. And I think that's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Mark, I believe.
Yeah, thanks, Janet. Thank you, Peter, for that summary. I would like just like to acknowledge that the new guidance on both 157 for the valuation of securities in inactive markets and also on 115 with respect to the credit portion of OTTI, we will be looking to see whether or not any conforming amendments to existing standards are appropriate, and any additional guidance would be helpful. And we will, of course, the discussion that we have following will be of importance to that consideration. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Okay, let's open it up for any comments regarding that point. If anyone has any, I thought we would just devote any comments to this fair value issue, whether or not we should need to make any conforming amendments or issue guidance, as Mark just indicated. And then once we finish that, open it up for discussion of other emerging issues in general.
Jen, I may have mentioned this last night, but it just as a reminder that our remit is the audit implications and not the accounting side. So that to the extent that you can direct your comments toward the audit implications, that's what we're looking for in this portion of the conversation.
Hal.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking to probably 85% of the companies in the S&P 500, in particular the banks that are having to deal with 157. And one of the comments that we get back pretty consistently is that the companies read the standard, but the auditor, quote, the auditor, cannot move off of the last price. So even though there may be, all signs that there was the last price was a distressed price, there seems to be an unwillingness or misunderstanding of what the standard requires, but they view that as the only answer, and they can't seem to get beyond some quoted price, no matter how distressed it may be. So I was looking for feedback, comments. Are we hearing the correct things from the banks? The banks are blaming on the auditors, and we're hearing other people blaming it on others. I don't know who to believe at this point.
Well, I think that was a good comment, and certainly look to others on the SAG that have experience or observations on that. Certainly the auditors, they audit to the accounting framework. And what you're indicating is there's some tension kind of regarding that, the interpretation of that. Interested in comments from the auditors that are here, or if others have any similar views or different views? Jim Schnur?
Well, I think one of the things you said gets to the point, which is they believe the transactions that we're observing are distressed, and I don't know that that's I think that one of the things the FASB was trying to do was to help clarify what's distressed. But I think that becomes really the big point of contention. I think the auditors also have, in some cases, access to a lot of information because they're dealing with a lot of clients and they're dealing with different sources of information in terms of pricing services and broker quotes. And they can't ignore that information. I think, an investor would be very offended if they ignored that information on a particular client. So I think some of from my perspective, those are, where some of the maybe disagreement comes from.
Peter Prostakis?
Yeah, along that lines, of course, I don't know what the final words will be until we actually draft it, but we are... But we have tried to deal with that a little bit by saying something to the effect of, when the market is significantly decreased, no one price is likely to be determinative. And so we're trying to lead to using multiple approaches and then looking at the variability of the answers that you get with each.
How did you want to interject?
I just wanted to follow up. One of the things I've heard is that, you know, when there becomes this tension or this disagreement in terms of whether that's a distressed price, one approach that I've heard that seems workable to me is that you take the price that's in the market, and then you plug it back into some valuation model, and you look at the assumptions that would be required to get to that market price. If you can show that any of the individual assumptions, for example, one of the assumptions may be that unemployment rate is, to get to that answer, would have to be 14%. And you come back and say, well, it's not likely that unemployment would be 14% to trigger that default to get to that valuation. So you could start to disprove it, but that there's a lot of work involved in that. And what we're hearing is that the auditors aren't willing to go that far. That there is a price, they understand there may be this model out there, but since the model differs from the market price, they're not going back and looking at the individual assumptions that go into it, kind of reverse engineering what you would need to get to that market price. And it just kind of seems to break down at that point. That, again, this is feedback that we're getting.
Sam Renzella, is that?
Let me just respond to that. I think the one shortcoming I see in that approach is the model doesn't comprehend the liquidity discount, the fact that the market, there's so much uncertainty in the market. So if you're looking at, a loan that's secure or a security that's collateralized by a loan, and you look at, or a bunch of loans, and you're looking at all the underlying assumptions about what would happen to housing prices or whatever, you still don't have in that model the discount rate associated with the liquidity discount. Mm-hmm. And that is fundamentally where what the issue is. I mean, I think, the model that they have is it's not fair value. It may be some sort of fundamental value or base value or long-term value, but it doesn't take into account liquidity discount.
Sam, are you ready?
Clearly not. at least not from this report I just heard. I'm going to stay here and write auditing standards. I think how you have to decide when you look at this, do you believe that the prices on the books are just too low and they don't represent an exit price? And that's what you have to believe. And do you think that based on your intent that you can hold a security until a market becomes orderly or active again, that you should end up with a different price on your books than somebody who cannot wait for that market or may not be able to wait for that market? And if you believe that, you ought to get two different answers based on the way in which an entity holds a security, then I don't think you ought to call them both fair value. And I'd be very supportive of another concept around fundamental value, economic value, and inherent value. I'm fine with that. Call it what it is. But I think what we've been, I'll hold judgment, but I don't think what we heard today is going to help the situation very much. At least that's my cut on what I just heard. I don't think this is going to help us deal with this gap very, very well. And so, but without having seen the words, then I think you have to, I'll have to defer judgment.
I'd have to agree. What you're arguing is probably our later discussion about going concern. There's a valuation for going concern, and can I hold on to that and dispose of it in a truly functioning market? I think that's one value. And then there's that liquidation value concept, and very honestly, we're already pricing some companies, particularly banks, at liquidation values. So I would not be opposed to something along those lines. But the market's already doing it. Question is, will the accounting catch up to reflect it?
I would say, though, that there's a difference between a liquidation value and an exit value in the current market, because I would say the use of the word liquidation is pejorative, implying that it is a forced transaction. And if that's right, then we should have allowed the FSB to go forward with where it was. I would argue with you that the observable transactions in the market, not all of those are distressed transactions.
I'm arguing that they all are distressed.
But if you're saying liquidation value, to me, liquidation value is pejorative relative to the term fair value.
I don't know if it's pejorative, but different.
Okay. Okay, I'll go there too.
Okay. Arnold Schilder.
A bit out of the same concern about the auditability, I wondered whether Peter could elaborate a bit more on the expected wording. If I'm reading on page 6 of the handout, paragraph 13, then I'm reading a lot of emphasis on decisions and judgments made by the entity. The entity would conclude whether the transaction was orderly based, and a bit further, in estimating fair value, more weight should be placed on transactions that the reporting entity concludes are orderly. Less weight should be placed on transactions that the reporting entity doesn't have sufficient information to conclude. A reporting entity do not have to incur undue cost and effort in making these determinations. So am I reading this right, that basically the whole emphasis is now with the entity? So, well, this is our judgment and you have to accept it as an auditor? Or how else would that discussion go if the auditor would say, I'm not convinced? And this leaves that discussion pretty open and judgmental. And I wondered whether Peter could elaborate a bit more on whether it more or less will stay like this, which I think is a concern from the auditability perspective, or that it is still open to further discussion, et cetera.
I'm not sure I can opine on how the auditor is going to verify those judgments, but there's no doubt that what this application guidance does is it puts more reliance on judgments that are made by the reporting entity. I think we feel that most of the time you're not really going to have any discrete evidence to be able to determine whether the transaction is distressed or not, but to the extent you can make that assessment, then that will be part of your decision making. All we're really trying to do here is to ever so slightly move away from the natural tendency to go to a transaction price and say there's different ways that you can come up with the value, and you should consider all of that and do some comparisons. And if you have a wide variability, then maybe you need to do more work. But clearly, the press is picking up flexibility and leeway. Yeah, there's flexibility not in the notion of an exit value, but there's flexibility in the approach that you would use to develop it. So I don't have an easy answer.
Thank you. Kurt Schott, I think you're next.
I'm tempted to talk about the standard setting process, but Mark keeps kicking me here. So to keep this in the framework of audits, what is an auditor to do, and will there be a need for some PCAOB guidance on looking at the decision? And I want to talk about the impairment side of this. The intent does not intend to sell the security, and it is more likely than not that the entity will not be required to sell the security before recovery. What does an auditor do with that?
I think, you know, that's a, Finn, did you want to take a? Well, I think, you know, that's kind of the questions we're trying to get at here today, if, you know, if there's anything, you know, what any guidance or anything that might help.
Well, the only thing I was just going to bring up, I mean, today for equity security, I mean, there's a SEC SAB, right? It's topic, I think it's M, right? But SAB 59, that has the notion of ability and intent that's there. And now this notion for debt securities is a little bit different than now the notion for equity securities. But, I mean, we've been doing that for a while. I'm just saying that that particular concept's not a new concept. Don't get me wrong, there is going to be challenges with respect to what has been put out and the auditability around those challenges. I mean, we can start at, I think there's an expectation gap between what is probably being picked up in the press and between what, you know, and expectations. Is this going to go further? It does have flexibility on, you know, what you're looking at in the what is distressed or not distressed, but they have reiterated the concept of exit price, and then it's very difficult when you go to, okay, exit price, move and do a model to an orderly transaction, an orderly market, and I think that is a inherently judgmental and very difficult. But a company's got to come up with their assumptions, and we're going to need to review those assumptions like we do in a lot of estimates. But it's going to be very difficult.
Randy Fletchall.
Jennifer, I want to go back to Hal's observation from his calls, what he's heard from various people. There's probably no winning answer I could give here, and so if I was smart, I probably would just keep quiet, but I don't think I can. I'm somewhat pained by what I've been hearing for several months about what auditors are not doing. And I will tell you, Vin just said it, these are very, very tough estimates to audit. And I think auditors are under these very unusual circumstances in a very crazy market are doing a darn good job of trying to exercise judgment and not, in fact, just accept an answer and try to rationalize it with I'm using judgment. We have been talking about a respect for judgment for some time now, and that means we have to act in a manner that says we deserve to have that judgment respected. I think that's what we're trying to do. But each time someone doesn't like that answer, it gets played back as you're scared to exercise judgment. I think we're doing it today, and I think we're doing it about as well as we can in a very, very tough environment with things that are very, very tough to estimate. And that doesn't mean from time to time in some place someone doesn't come up with an answer that they think we might all say, that was a little conservative in that case. But you can't be judged based on what might happen in one place here or one place there when people truly are doing, I think, a pretty darn good job from the vantage point I see, the consultations that take place, the effort that goes into trying to figure out what that best estimate is. It does pain me to hear that, no, you just kind of like to take the last price and go on, and whatever the lower number is better. That's not the way I see it operating, despite what I read and hear.
Thanks, Randy. Galen Hansen.
My twin down here just nudged me a few minutes ago and said, life has just gotten a lot harder for you, Galen, and I think he's absolutely right. And I would agree with what Randy just said. I don't see auditors just inadvertently choosing these values, but I think this is putting us in a situation where we're going to be talking about going concern this afternoon, and instead of talking about 1 year, it'll be 2 or 3 years where we're looking at assumptions out the line in terms of the ability to hold and testing that intent. I have a hard time believing that just accepting somebody's on the paper expression of we intend to hold this is going to be enough from an audit evidence standpoint.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Coleman already answered this, but I thought I'd just ask it again. Relating to the other than temporary impairments, FSP, as proposed, there was a dissent by two of the board members on several issues, and one of the issues that they dissented on, which, as I understand it from Peter, is going to be in the final FSP, is on splitting the impairment loss between the portion of the loss related to credit and then to all other. In the dissent, the proposal, the two board members who sent it indicated that, at least in some cases, if not in many cases, it's really a fiction that you can make that split. So obviously that split is important because, and there's going to be a lot of pressure around that split because one of the numbers goes into net income and earnings per share immediately and the other number doesn't. So there's obviously going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on how that split is done. So my question is, one, do the auditors feel comfortable in auditing that split? And two, will the PCAOB inspection process take a look at the auditor's evaluation of that split, or will there be some evaluation by the PCAOB at some point related to how auditors handle that, what some would claim a fiction? How are they going to audit what some would say is a fiction?
Well, let me look to the auditors that are on the standing advisory group to respond to that split regarding OTTI. Anyone? Jim Schnur? Sorry.
Well, I think the proposal was actually, there was a lot of confusion about how you would do that. I think, I know we responded, I think many of the other firms responded that if you, and I believe in the final standard, while it will not be a requirement, I think there will be, or I believe there will be, the approach towards the credit piece will be expected cash flows, which I think we have experience in auditing. I do have a concern that if somebody were to use another measurement of the credit risk, how we would get comfortable with that, but not having had an opportunity to, understand how, a client would do that or a specialist would do that. It's hard to answer that. But I think if most companies use expected cash flows to make that measurement, then I think we know how to audit that.
Sam, did you want to comment as well?
Well, I agree with Jim, but I think what we know how to audit that and we'd be comfortable with the split using expected cash flows and the discount rate that's inherent in the instrument. And I think one of the misconceptions has on this bifurcation of the change in fair value has been the proposal that you're trying to strip the credit risk from all other risks and just take the credit risk into P&L and put everything else into equity. That is not what is being done. What is being done is to make some provision for an incurred credit loss, like you do on a loan, and put that incurred credit loss through the P&L, and then the rest of the change in fair value. And I think we know how to do that. If we don't, there's loans, portfolios, and loan loss allowances. But to Jim's point, if somebody wanted to go and try to say, I'm going to try to determine the change in credit risk versus all other risks to define that movement between carrying value and fair value, I think that is very, very difficult, and we would struggle with that. But that is not, at least not my understanding of what the FSP will require.